we started a series last week talking about God, politics, and being the church. And mostly last week we talked about being the church, and I want to re-say a couple things that we said last week for those of you that weren't here. The reason we're doing this is obvious. In 2 days we have an election, and I feel like, and maybe this is true for many of you, I feel like in my lifetime this has probably been as ugly as it's gotten in an election. And I understand there's lots of times in American history where things have been tense and big elections, but it just feels like there's a level of ugh that all of us feel this year that probably maybe none of us have ever experienced before. And so decided to talk about politics. So on the back of your notes is some references. I stole some things from Rob Bell that he says that are really good. And there's also an article from The Atlantic that somebody sent me this week that I thought was particularly good. And so those links are back there. A couple things I want to say before we talk about being a Christian in American politics is that where we get our word politics comes from the Greek word for city, which is polis. So that is just the Greek word for city. And the citizens of the city were known as the politikos. So when we start talking about politics, this is the phrase from Rob Bell that's really helpful, and it's been really useful for me over the last couple weeks, is when we talk about politics in its most noble form, we're talking about our shared life together. And I said last week that, you know, my family, we have politics in my family. We have a shared life as a family, and we have rules in our family for what it means to share our space together, what it means to take care of dishes and laundry and how we sit at the table together and when we play our drums and when we don't play our drums. We have rules for these things because we have a shared life together. And just because Caleb decides at 10:30 at night, now's a good time to play drums, doesn't mean it's a good time to play drums for the rest of us. He doesn't do that, but I'm just saying. We have a shared life together. We share the space, and so we're working that out. And so last week I talked about being a church, and we have a shared life together as a church, and what does it mean to think about our shared life together as a church? And at the heart of all of this is policy, the rules by which we've agreed to live in our shared life together. So that's the language that we're using. And so what I tried to say last week was that there's a nobility to that. And despite the way we use the word, despite the sneers that we have about, you know, that's political, and we use it in a really ugly way, there's a nobility to it. Somebody needs to decide how we share our life together. Somebody needs to decide when we repair a road and when we don't, and how we spend money and how we don't. Because there's a lot of us in America, there's a lot of us in our church. Somebody needs to decide all that, because we all have different opinions, right? If I asked any issue, like how much should we spend in defense spending this year, policy-wise, I'm sure I would have 170 different answers, right? Right? All the way probably from some of you saying zero to some of you saying twice as much as we do now, right? Like there'd be a wide range of opinions. So politics is the noble art of getting together and figuring out what can we do that is the most good for the most of us. Okay, are we all there? That's a recap of last week, so let's move on. So this morning, I want to talk about church politics, American politics, and specifically, I want to say, like, answer this question eventually, is what does it mean to be a Christian in American politics? Because I think that's a hard pathway sometimes, right? Like, what does it even mean to be Christian? And lots of people are going around saying they're Christian and saying that, hey, this is what it means to be Christian in politics. And I think a lot of us are cringing about that. So what does it mean to be American in politics? So let me start here. And I don't want to spend a lot of time here because we could turn this into a whole lot of griping. When I say that politics is a noble thing, the nobility of politics, I'm going to put up a slide in just a minute that gives you some of the problems or the things that I think corrode the nobility of politics. For the rest of us, before I put mine up, what are the things that corrode, and I'm not talking partisan things, I'm just talking in general, what are the things that erode that nobility that we see happening all around us? When you think about what's happening around us, what is it that's corrosive to the nobility of politics? Money. When we feel like people's voices are for sale, that because of money, one person or a very few get a lot more say than the many. And so the interests of one outweigh, I didn't even mean that at all, I just said it, outweigh the voice of the many because somebody has money. Okay, what else? Oh, yeah, right. when we find out somebody's told us something, but they've told somebody else something else, and then they get caught. Good theater. What else? Power and personal interest. Flesh that out a little bit. Yeah, so when we see somebody that what appears to us, at least, that it's about their own advancement or their own personal platform or whatever. A couple more. What else corrodes the nobility of politics? Oh, so that's corrosive to politics is the idea that the answer to our problems is simple. I'm going to say this a little bit later when it comes to truth. We have a complexity toward, or we have a bias. Our brains have a bias towards simple answers, right? When somebody says, think about this, all right? You've just shared something with somebody about yourself. I feel like this happens in meetings with people sometimes, and people will say, oh, well, it's when you share your problem and it's like angsty to you and it's hard and it's complicated, and then somebody responds with, oh, it's simple. How does that make you feel? It's not simple, or I would not be sitting here torn up about this decision. It's not simple, and we have a bias towards simplicity. When people keep telling us the problems are simple, it's just this thing or that thing. Just if we just do this, it'll fix everything. That kind of corrodes it because it's not simple. Everything that's debated in policy in our country is complicated because 300 plus million people have different ideas. And trying to do the most good for the most people in our shared life together is not simple. And if you've ever tried to dive even a little bit into any particular policy, it gets really complicated really fast. Good. Unwavering certainty. You want to say more? Yeah. So I said it this way. It's my way or the highway. Or I also think of this as the I'll take my ball and go home. That ideology is greater than solution. So what we want in the nobility of politics, what we say, is we don't care what you believe, get in the room and figure it out. And when people say, I refuse to talk to that person, I refuse to enter the room, I refuse to consider your idea, that erodes the nobility of politics, right? What I want to say to all of our politicians sometimes is get in the room. That's why we put you there. The stonewalling, I won't do this, I'm going to take my ball and go home, I'm not going to do your, like that, that's not the nobility. That's not what that is. Nobility is you keep working it out and you keep trying to find solutions. That's why you're there, is to find solutions for all of us. Oh, yeah. And then the demonization of the other, that they are completely evil because they think differently and see the world differently than me. Yes, good. All right, one or two more, and then let's get to good things. Yes, that they're acting like children erodes the nobility of politics. Good, I like that. Fear-mongering. Play with that idea just a minute. Yeah. So there's some, for you Anya geeks, there's some people that do Enneagram teaching that believe as many as half of the American population tests as a six. And that a six struggles with anxiety. And so the appeal to fear appeals to something like half the population. So if I can just make them scared, then they will vote for me. And so when we see that being played out, and it, for those of us that don't have that same thing about fear and we see it being played out, it makes us just cringe inside. It's like, oh, that is such a naked appeal to fear. Be afraid, you need me, or doomsday, right? Which, can we just be honest, both parties are guilty of in different ways. It's endemic to the whole thing. Okay, one or two more. I keep saying one or two more. Wait, time out. This feels like something I want to put on mic because I'm not going to be able to recap. I'm teaching a class on the Middle East right now and recap that for you all. So go.
So we're talking about the Syrian conflict, right?
It's yes.
Obviously really complicated. And I think we've identified at least 11 different contesting factions, right, in the war wow. itself. And obviously we focus just on Daesh or ISIS as the single problem. And I remember in the primaries, there was a candidate who will remain nameless who said, our solution is simple, we just make the sand glow, right? This was yeah. literally a quote, and I find it so offensive, but also it's so destructive, right? Like to our understanding of the problems that we actually face, to our standing in the world, to our national yeah. discourse, to speak like that.
Yeah. What's scary is maybe our politicians sometimes actually believe that the solutions are that simple. but that maybe they even believe their own rhetoric, which is even scarier than it's just scare tactics, that maybe they even believe the rhetoric that it's just as simple as if you just wipe it all out, it'll be done. Kevin. Yes. Yes, so that's on us, right? That our attention span. So, like, I was laughing after one of the debates where Hillary Clinton was made fun of for being too policy-minded in the debate. Like, boring, move on. Wait, time out! That's what we're supposed to be doing! We're supposed to be talking policy and the complexities of Syria, not like one-liners. We're supposed to be doing it, and that's on us, right? That's us corroding the nobility of politics when we can't stay in the room to listen to a well-reasoned argument for more than 5 minutes. Yikes, right? Okay, Mary, you're the last word. Well done. All the time I have is for a meme. All right. I hope that came through the podcast. If not, you all just missed a gem. I think the last one I put up here, maybe we've kind of hit around the edges of it, is when our politicians have a mentality. I think this had to do with whoever said the thing about power, maintaining power, that whatever it takes to win, that winning is the thing, that maintaining control is the thing. I don't know if you've ever studied the issue of gerrymandering. By the way, when I was in high school, I was taking my civics test, and it's one of my shining moments in high school where I actually made my history teacher cry because out of laughter at me and then sadness that I was so dumb. The question on the test is, what is gerrymandering? And I responded with a stupid answer like, gerrymandering was a guy who lived in blah, 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 blah. And it was funny at the time. But the idea of gerrymandering is like, we're just going to draw the districts to maintain our hold of power because the most important thing is not people's voices, but is power. And so when we hear people talk in those kinds of ways, and the thing I said last week about everybody's voice just changes to stay in power. So I use this example of like when Scalia died and Obama was like, I'm going to nominate a Supreme Court justice, and the Republicans said like, no, we don't take people in the last year of the election. I don't need to recap all this, right? And I said in the moment, like, and I think this is true, we don't know, but I think this is true, that if it would have been a Republican sitting in the White House, and it would have, and they would have been, and the Democrats would have been controlling the House, they would, or the Senate, they would have all had the exact opposite views, right? And I believe that to my very core. We just argue and believe whatever's pertinent to winning right now, and it feels like people don't even have a voice, like a real voice. Like, what do you really believe? Well, I believe whatever it'll take to get me to win. And I think that for a lot of us, that starts eroding the nobility of politics. So if we're going to talk about nobility of politics, I believe, so the thesis of this whole talk is that being a Christian in politics should mean something different than all the things on that screen. That if we're going to be agents of change in our world, that being a Christian should lead us down different pathways than those pathways that we see all around us. And I think, I'll just tell you up front, I think that sometimes as Christians, we get caught up, I get caught up in the drama of our political stuff. And then I wonder afterwards, like, in what way was I Christian in that exchange? And so I want to just, what I want to do this morning is just put a whole bunch of ideas out. I feel like I say this all the time, I could have done 3 messages, but I want to just offer some ideas. And I hope out of this, that maybe these are ideas that get talked about in your small groups or in your friend groups or wherever else you are, that maybe, or with your spouse, that maybe inspire you to think maybe differently. And then I'm going to talk about some practices at the end, to like, how might we very practically as Christians engage over the next 2, 3, 4 days? Because it's going to be impossible not to talk about this stuff in the next couple days. I say, like, can we all take a minute and thank God for the Chicago Cubs? Because for the last month, they've been like a welcome distraction to everything else. I was at Childers the other morning waiting for a meeting early in the morning, and there was like 4 tables around me, and thank God they were all talking about the Cubs. And it warmed my heart. Made me so happy for the first time in my life. But I'm sure that had the Cubs not been doing what they were doing, all those tables would have been talking about politics, right? And I'm sure Monday morning if I have a meeting, I don't know if I do or not, but if I have a meeting there, that's what the conversation's going to be in our workplaces and in our homes and in schools and everywhere, because it's big stuff. So how do we go about being Christian in our context? So there's two verses that I want to read to you that kind of form the bedrock of what I'm thinking this morning. So two verses, four ideas, and three practices in 15 minutes. Are you ready? All right. So just a couple weeks ago, if you're new to us, we've been journeying through the Gospel of John. And so a couple weeks ago, we came up to this space in John. So what's happened in John at this very moment is Jesus has just finished washing the disciples' feet. And John makes a big point in the text to say, especially Judas's feet. Like Jesus, it's almost as if in the text, Jesus like hurried and was like, uh-oh, Judas is going to lead to betray me. I better wash his feet real quick before he goes and does that, which none of us do that, right? Like, whoa, how does he do that? And then he says to them, a new commandment I give you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. And so one of the things I said back then, and I've just been thinking about this verse. By the way, I grew up in a tradition where people had life verses. Like you claimed a verse in the Bible. It's like, this is my very special verse, I think is what it was. And people picked all kinds of different ones. And there was points for like creativity and uniqueness. And then everybody picks Philippians 4:13 or whatever. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Or Jeremiah, I know the plans I have for you, saith the Lord, Jeremiah 29, that one. I never growing up heard anybody say, you know, the thing that was most important to Jesus, that's the thing that's most important to me. I don't know why that's true. This ought to be the most important verse to you in all the Bible, right? When Jesus says, this is the thing I'm going to leave you with, we ought to pay attention to that. Anyway, and then I said a couple weeks ago, and I want to reiterate, love one another, but not just love as you define it or how you feel, but rather the character of your love is defined by what I just did. I just washed your feet. That's what it looks like to love. Love one another in the same kind of way that I've loved you. How I've been with you, how I've washed your feet, that's the manner in which you go about loving. You don't just stand up in places and say, I love everybody, that's good enough. But rather, it's Jesus kind of love. We're actually following after Jesus when the love that we have is love that is actually demonstrated in doing good things for others. And you don't get to just say that I'm a follower of Jesus. What Jesus says is, no. People will say that you're a follower of me when they see you living like this. That's how it works. You get to claim followership when you actually demonstrate love in the same kind of ways that I did. So that should be the undergirding, the foundation of any kind of engagement of Christians in politics ought to be there. The second verse, and this one, I just want to put this out because it's going to come back. Summing it all up, friends, this is from Philippians. This is out of the message. I'd say you'll do best by filling your minds and meditating on things true, noble, reputable, authentic, compelling, and gracious. The best, not the worst. The beautiful, not the ugly. Things to praise, not things to curse. Put into practice what you've learned from me, what you've heard, saw, and realized. Do that, and God, who makes everything work together, will work you into his most excellent harmonies. Don't you love that? God will work you into his harmonies. So the idea, and I've said this in other places, and I think N.T. Wright talks about this idea, that if God is blowing this way, if the winds are blowing this way, we align our ships, like sailing ships, right, is the analogy here. We align our ships with the wind of God when we meditate and fill our minds with things that are true, noble, reputable, authentic, compelling, gracious. So when we engage in the political sphere, when we do those things, we are aligned with the wind of God. And if we're not about those things, if we say like truth, then we aren't aligned with what God is doing in the world. Now, this talk is not about Republican politics versus Democratic Republican politics versus independent politics or whatever you want. We're going to say in this space that you can be a Christian and get to all of those. I would love to argue with all of that, right? Like maybe someday there's a discussion about, I'm going to say this and then I'm going to set it aside because I want to just riff on this for a long time. I hope that when you walk into the ballot box on Tuesday, whatever you punch as a Christian, not whomever, whatever the things, whomever you vote for and however you vote has been informed by your beliefs and what it means to be a child of God and not just whatever else there is out there that motivates you. I'm going to assume of our church that everybody is choosing who they're choosing and backing who they're backing because of their Christian conviction. Maybe that's not a safe assumption. Somebody just made a face over here. Maybe that's not a safe assumption. But I think highly of you all, and I'm just going to assume that and set that aside. That's another discussion for another time. What I'm talking about then is as we engage, as Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Annoyeds, however we engage, I want to talk about those kinds of ways based on those two verses. And there's lots of other verses I could have chosen, but just those two. So let me talk about some postures. So let's hit the first one. I think then out of those verses that one of the ideas for me is that we're moving from a mentality that's all about retribution to one that's about restoration. We say here sometimes that we believe, I haven't said this in a while, I just got a brand new book by N.T. Wright, and you're going to hear so much about it at Lent because it's just reading the cover, so good. And I heard a podcast with him. But this idea that he says, we need to get the end goal in sight, that what God is doing in the world is the restoration of all things, putting it all back together, making all things right. And somehow our theology, and I think it comes out of our eschatology, but again, that's another discussion. Our theology has led us to believe that what God is about doing is punishing everybody that's wrong. And sometimes punishment is a part of something, but what I'm more interested in, let me just use the example of my kids. When my kids do wrong, yes, sometimes there's a punishment involved, but that punishment is only to the degree that it serves in their restoration, that it helps them become better, that it helps them put back the thing that they've broken, the thing that they've done wrong, that helps them become whole again, relationally with us or with other people or whatever it is. My interest in my relationship with them is to restore them back to goodness. This is what God is doing in all of creation. We believe deep in our bones, the Christian belief is that God is restoring and making all things new, putting it all back together. And so part of what it means to be a Christian, I believe, as we engage in political discussions, is that we believe in restoration over simple retribution. So when we talk about people, the phrase, they get what they deserve, isn't the end of our conversation, but rather how do we systematically help people move towards wholeness? When we talk about all of us and our shared life together, how do we talk about the restoration of everything that's wrong? And sometimes that's a temporary fix, but oftentimes it's much deeper and the problems are a lot more complicated than, we'll just do this. So a second posture is moving from my to our. I think early in a journey, and let me just use it in spiritual language, early in a spiritual journey, we start with our own salvation project. Oh, God save me from my own sins, like that. Like we start there, but that part of spiritual growth is my definition of our is eternally and always expanding outward. The who is us gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So it doesn't just be, it's not just me and my family and not just me and my family and my neighbors and not just me and my family and my neighbors and the people I like, but is always expanding out to include more people into who is us. That part of this loving everybody as Jesus and loving everyone means that I don't even just care about American politics, but I'm also concerned with how does this sit in the rest of the world whom we're neighbors with. What does that mean for, I was listening to a piece, I think it was on NPR yesterday, talking about Mexico and how their economy depends on the outcomes of the election. And as poll numbers have gone different ways, the Mexican economy is following our polling because of the outcomes of potential one versus the other. It's not just about us. And I think, and I'm going to say more of this next week when we talk about kingdom politics, is as followers of Jesus, this loving people doesn't just stop at the people I like and the people that I know, but extends out a lot further than that. And part of the spiritual journey, I believe, is this expansiveness that is growing to include everybody else. Thirdly, and this is the one I wanted to do the whole sermon on, to move from partisans to truth tellers. Here's a struggle I have. So I got in a little bit of trouble this spring. We had that Peace for Peoria event. I don't know if you all remember this. So we had Imam Mufti and Daniel Bogard, the rabbi, and myself and Jim Powell and the Catholic guy, and we did a panel. And afterwards, nothing I said got me in trouble, but some people came up to me afterwards and caught me doing something that I forgot that I don't do. And they said, I had several people come afterwards like, so you don't say the Pledge of Allegiance, do you? I was like, oh, shoot. So about 10 years ago, I felt really convicted, this thing about partisans and truth-telling, and I just felt like to pledge allegiance to something is a really, really big deal to me. And sometimes my allegiance to Jesus and my allegiance to America, they don't line up. And so to pledge allegiance to something means it gets preeminence, right? To me, it does. This isn't for all of you all. I'm not trying to tell you what you can and can't do. It just means for me, I only can pledge allegiance to one thing. And so Jesus is where I pledge my allegiance. So if America and Jesus conflict, I'm going with Jesus. And so for me, a practical outworking of that is that when people say the pledge, I don't. I stand respectfully, I face the flag, and I stand there, and it's okay, and I love America, and I'll fly my flag out in front of my house on Veterans Day. I think America's the best country in the history of the world, and it has problems, right? But for me, it's a way of separating out my partisanship to America and my commitment to truth. And that sometimes being a citizen of God's kingdom means that I need to speak the truth to America and say, boy, the values of America here are wrong because Jesus. And so that's my own practice, and it caused some ripples for me. No big deal. What I'm suggesting is in this dedication to whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is just, whatever is, I'm just making up words right now, what our commitment to that means, I think that it will call us into increasing conflict with partisanship. Because it means that we're going to have to stand up and say sometimes to our party, who we might agree with the ideals, nope, that's not true. And that's on both sides of the aisle, right? So let's pause for just a minute. Let me ask a question. It's an important question. Why is milk in the back of the grocery store? If I need to stop and get milk on the way home from, this really does have something to do with what we're talking about. Just follow me for a minute. When I walk into the store today to get milk, if I did, and go into Hy-Vee, the milk is in the very back left. It's as far away from the door as it can possibly get. And I just need milk. And the whole time, I'm so irritated with this whole thing. Why is milk in the back of the store? What do you know? Cold chain is one idea. They sell more. All right, let's just do a poll real quick. How many of you, those two solutions, how many people believe it's that those stores can sell more? How many of you have been told that your whole life? Yeah. How many of you believe that cold chain nonsense? Why do we believe that it's because they can sell more stuff? Tell me why you believe that. Have you worked in a grocery store? No? And he said, and he taught you that? It's about the placement, all right? What else? That's so good. It's your own experience, right? Right. So there's a truth to it. Same reason they put candy at the checkout. Same reason they put all the name brands at eye level, right? There's some of that. And the sugary cereal at the kids' level. And the women's clothes in the front of Target. This is fun. Go on. They are both true, actually. And one is truer than the other. Here's the thing, the way our minds work. I've believed my whole life that the reason milk is in the back of the store is so that they could sell us more stuff. Because I'm sure somewhere along the way, that's what my mom or dad said. And it just feels true, right? It just feels true. Because it happens. I go to the back of the store, I get my milk, and on the way by, I'm like, ooh, I need beer too. What else goes with milk? The truth is, I was just listening to a podcast 2 days ago, and it rocked my world. The truth is the we'll buy more stuff is just a nice side effect. It's really not the reason. The main reason is cold chain. Milk has to stay cold. Milk comes delivered on a cold truck. It's delivered straight into the back of the store into a cold room, and it goes onto the shelves in a cold place. And in fact, if I were to go to Hy-Vee tonight, they've actually arranged it for my convenience as such that if I enter into the store on the front right, my right, and work a way around, I come to the back left at the end so the milk will stay colder. I don't want to pick up milk at the beginning of my shopping trip. I want to pick up my milk and the frozen goods at the very end. And they've arranged the store in such a way that I can walk around and do the milk and the frozen stuff last. It would cost us, the milk buyers, more money to put the milk in the front of the store because then they would have to figure out how to transport milk through the store and keep it cold at the same time. And they'd have to pay workers to do that. And it's the most popular item. So it's better for us as the consumer, and it keeps milk prices down for us to go to the back of the store where they can keep it cold the longest and we can pick it up ourselves. And in fact, a consultant says, I tell stores all the time, figure out a way to get the milk at the front of the store because like every other store in America, you give customers what they want. If you went on Dick's on Thursday, they didn't put the Cubs gear in the back to make you walk through the store. They put it right out front because that's what you want. And stores should do the same thing. He's like, it's so frustrating because every time I start saying move it to the front and give the customer what they want, I get cold chain stuff. The main answer is cold chain. I'll send you the link. It was on the Planet Money podcast. So they talk to consultants that consult supermarkets. They talk to people that own like Kroger's, the big chain people like that stuff. So even at the mom and pop level or people that own individual ones, we give both reasons. But when they talk to consultants and people who are like food science people, like science of consumer, blah, 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 it's a really good piece. And it's really, some of them were people that work for a store. Another one I believe was a professor at Cornell. And so they had two guys on the podcast, just so you know where I got this. They had two guys on the podcast, Michael Pollan, who was making the argument for the to sell more stuff argument, and another person that, wait, I'm way off the point of this whole thing. If you want the link, I'll send you the link to the Radiolab podcast. My point is this. Truth is a really tough thing for us sometimes. What we think is true often is just what we feel like is true. We hear something and we think, oh, that feels true. So I'm going to pick on just Republican radio for just a minute. There's been a popular thing that's gone around in Republican radio for the last couple of years that President Obama has golfed in office more than any other president in history. Have you heard this? I have, and I don't listen that much to talk radio. It's not even close to true. But it feels true, and so we just repeat it. And so when we start dealing in truth, I think one of the big challenges us as Christians is that we need to be willing in ourselves to examine truth. And willing to listen. And so when somebody says, well, the milk, oh, well, give me the evidence. Let me weigh that out and sort that out. The challenge for most of us is that we aren't open to examining our truth claims. And then I think what happens then is if we are convinced of truth and we do know truth, the challenge to us gets really practical is that what do I do with truth in the moment? So just the other morning, last Saturday morning, Jackson and I had gone paintballing with some people, and I'd met a bunch of people I didn't really know. And so the dads were sitting around after we were done paintballing and talking about politics, and it was the day the FBI, the most recent FBI leak had come out the night before. And this guy I was sitting next to was talking about the things that are in the emails, and I'm sure she didn't want these out. He was saying some things that were just not even true. And in this moment, I'm faced with what does it mean to be a Christian in politics? What does it mean for me right now to stand up for truth? And I'm not partisan. I don't really care. But I said to the man, I said, to be fair, she had a press release this morning, because I'd seen the news before I'd come over to play. She had a press release this morning asking that all the emails be released as fast as possible. She's not trying to hide them. She wants them out as fast as possible. Now, she may have political reasons for that, blah, blah, blah. But in the moment, I was trying to be gracious, and I was trying to say, you know, what you just said about her trying to hide stuff, right, in this particular instance, just isn't true. And you may disagree with her, and you may think she's hid other things at other times, but in this specific instance, this isn't true. And what's happened, I think, and what I'm challenging us all to engage in a little bit, is even in whatever party we identify with, that the challenge to a Christian is to stand up and say, I agree with your policy. Yeah, I really think President Obama is the worst president in the history of presidents. You can believe that. But to say he's golfed more than any other president in history just simply isn't true. Or that he's taken more vacation than any other president. Not true. It's just not truth. And there's been something happening in America where not telling the truth is okay. It's just okay. That's part of what we consider political discourse now. Lie, lie, lie all you want. And that's where personally for me, this is my thing, is like I'm a PolitiFact junkie, right? Like I'm always on like studying like, oh, they said this thing. Is that true? Let's see if it's true. And there's plenty of websites that do that work for you that help you do that. And you can investigate those and see what's going on. And we all understand as adults that there's politicians that like, oh, that's kind of a creative telling of the facts, and liar, liar, pants on fire. And there's lots of liar, liar, pants on fire. And I would implore you, as people who are supposed to think on whatever is true and whatever is noble and whatever is just, we ought to be looking around our world and evaluating candidates on who's telling the truth. And we ought to be confronting that when we can, in gracious Christ-honoring ways. Let me hurry. Fourth posture is moving from incivility to love everyone. I don't know that I need to say a lot there. That one's the most obvious one, right? That in the Christian, as Christians engaged in politics, incivility, like, hey, let's just say a little simple one. It is rude to interrupt somebody while they're talking. Everybody seems to know this, except everybody that's on the news shows. Well played. Everybody seems to know this, except the people on the news shows, right? That there's a civility to what it means to be a Christian in the public sphere. I heard, and I wish I could find the source for this, and I don't have the source for this. I remember it was a couple years ago hearing a longtime politician say, it used to be in Washington, D.C., we could argue, and we could argue passionately about what we believed and what we should, laws we should pass, blah, blah, blah. And then when the day was over, we went to the bar and we had drinks together, and we talked about each other's families, and we cared about. And what Vicky said earlier about the demonization of the other side, this politician was saying, it's just not like that anymore. We leave work and the Republicans go over there and the Democrats go over there, and we really do believe that the other side is evil. And I think part of what it means to be a Christian in politics is coming back to spaces of we actually do loving things for people. If that person, Jesus says, if you identify that person as an enemy, that's the person you're supposed to go try to love. That's the person you're supposed to do loving things for. Can I tell you a really quick story? And I got to tell it in some vague ways. There's a pastor in town who, over the years, I've heard the things that he's said about me and things I've written on my blog and things he said about our church, and they're not, they haven't felt kind. They have felt critical, and I think the H word has been thrown around at me. I think he has said some things like me being a heretic and that kind of thing. And this summer, I met this pastor, and I was like, okay. And then like a couple weeks later, in a setting, and then a couple weeks later, we were sitting at a coffee shop. I was sitting at a coffee shop meeting somebody, and he comes over to my table and reintroduces himself. And I walked away from that encounter thinking, you know, if I would have seen him in this coffee shop, I would have gone to the other side of the coffee shop and put my headphones in and played Eminem. That's awful. I just wouldn't have done what he did. And it marked me that despite the fact that he disagrees with probably almost everything I believe about God and the Bible and things, he made the initiative to come over and shake my hand. So last week, I heard that his church was going through a really hard time. They've had people leaving and just really bad stuff, and somebody told me a little bit about it. And so last week, I sent him an email, and I acknowledged our differences. I started with, you know, for years, I've told myself a story about what you think about me. And I said, I know you and I don't see the same, we don't see eye to eye on probably most of our theology. We believe very, very different things about God and salvation and the Bible, and it just, we don't line up. And I said, when you came over and said hi to me this summer, that felt like Jesus, and it really, it convicted me a little bit that I don't show the same civility back. And I said, so I'm writing you mostly this email just to say that I know you're going through a really hard time in your church, and I know that leadership is often lonely, and especially in hard times, it's really lonely. And I said, so I'm just letting you know, I'm just praying for you, and if there's anything else I can do for you, let me know. And he responded. And it probably will never go beyond there. Maybe it does. But for me, it was important to say, like, I've spent much of my life being uncivil to people that I disagree with, and that part of, I think, what it means to follow after Jesus is to practice civility, to actually do the things Jesus said about loving actions, loving people in the way that he defined it, and doing loving actions towards people whenever we can, and maybe especially when they're our enemy. So I wanted to end this morning real quick, and I'm going to fly through these really quickly. You can read the book. So last Sunday night, out of the Peace or Puri thing, a writer got involved, and there's a documentary film and a book called No Joke. I meant to bring one out here and hold it up for you. Called No Joke, about the relationship specifically between Jim Powell at Rich Woods and Camille Mufti, the imam, and Rabbi Bogard. And then all of us in the Puri area, and some of the good stuff that's happened in the relationships and in the conversations between Jews, Muslims, and Christians in our community. And so out of that, project, and we'll say more about that in January when the film actually comes out, and I've got some sample books if you're really interested. Out of that, they came up with three practices for how do you move to a space of relationship. And the premise of the idea is that agreement is not a pathway to relationship. Getting us all to agree with each other is not the pathway to friendship. If that's your pathway to friendship, have a lonely life, because people aren't going to agree with you. Nobody's going to agree with you about everything. My wife and I don't agree with each other about everything. We are not staking our relationship on our agreement on everything. So they say out of that, three practices. And I think these are good practices for interfaith, and I think they're good practices for inter-party politics, just good practices, all right? So the first one is I'll practice being unusually interested in others. Now, I want to define something. Not creepily interested in others. There's a line, right? Yeah. So there can be creepy interested in others. Tell me everything about you. But unusually interested, I'll just tell you, and I know you all feel this way, when somebody leans in and wants to know about you and is interested in you, boy, it makes you feel loved, right? This is what dating is. When you meet somebody for the first time and somebody is unusually interested in you and you can't spend enough time telling each other about each other and you feel so alive, like this person wants to know everything about me. The second practice is to practice staying in the room with difference. Just so you know, we've put our stake down on that in this church. So in this past year, we've declared our inclusivity. Everybody is welcome. You want to be a part of Imago, you're a part. That's all it takes. And specifically, we said for our LGBTQ friends that you're welcome here. This is an open space for you. And at the same time, we recognize that not all of you are entirely comfortable with that. And I want to say, I especially admire those of you in that space who are willing to stay in the room with difference. I'm not there, but I'm going to stay at the table. It's what families do, right? This is what families do, is families stay at the table. Well, some of you are like, not my family. And Thanksgiving's quickly approaching, but families stay at the table with difference. And you may think your crazy drunk uncle is, you know, like, whoa, but they're family. So you keep coming back to that table next year at Thanksgiving again, and you come back again and again. And part of this practice, I think, of being a Christian in the political sphere, and just frankly in any sphere, is that we'll practice staying in the room even when we disagree. And then finally, the last one is I'll stop comparing my best with your worst. I'll stop comparing. In this conversation, stop comparing all the great things about Christianity with ISIS. That's not fair. If we're going to compare ISIS to something, we ought to compare ISIS to the Ku Klux Klan. That's the comparison, not the best of what we do to the worst of what they do. But let's keep the comparisons fair. And so even in our politics, let's not compare the best of Republican politics to the worst of Democratic politics, but rather we'll practice in relationship comparing my best to your best. And we'll both acknowledge the worst of both of ours. Is that enough? Let me pray, and then we need to move to communion. I want to say about communion this morning, there's times where the table's so important, but at the table, I want to say the ground's level at the table, and so our servers come down to the ground, and it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter your politics, it doesn't matter what you think about this election and who you're going to vote for on Tuesday. If you're going to vote on Tuesday, that we're all brothers and sisters at the foot of the cross. And so I just want you to keep that in mind this morning as we take communion together. God, there's going to be lots of chances for us in the next couple days to take these practices to heart. I'm sure in our workplaces and in our friendships and in the circles and we run in and maybe in our neighborhoods, we're going to be challenged about what it means to be unusually interested in what other people think. And how we practice kindness and how we show love and how we sit with difference. And so, God, help us to be gracious. Help us to know when the right moment is to be a truth teller. Help us to know the gracious ways to speak truth, even when it conflicts with people that I love and mostly agree with. Help us to be lovers of all those things, whatever's true and whatever's noble and whatever's just and just whatever's beautiful. Help us to fill ourselves with those things. In your name I pray. Amen.